Session number 31558.
John Glasley Thompson, Reel 1. If we could start with when and where you were born.
I was born in Mari. It was India then, but now it's part of Kashmir. And my father was in the REMC because from the Great War. And I came back when I was about two and a bit, too young to remember anything of it, which was very unfortunate. And really, my generation, I think we all were brought up being prepared for the next war. All our parents, my friends as well, they used to think we knew jolly well with Hitler and so on, there was going to be a war. I remember my parents talking at a dinner party, which I was at when I was maybe 14, something like that, saying, oh yes, Churchill's our best chance, they thought.
Did your father talk much about his own experiences?
Yes, he did. He talked a bit about it, not very much, because it was so unfashionable to talk shop in those days. But after 1939, everybody seemed to talk shop all the time. Certainly in the regiment, really. And my uncle on my father's, my mother's side, her younger brother, was in the war in Salonika. And my father was he was medical officer to the 3rd Cavalry Division in France and Belgium. And he started the war riding on a horse, and then he ended up on a motorbicycle. And he had various stories of being shot at by airplanes and things like that, but he was not actually in the trenches. But George Carter at Cambridge was. He was a machine gun officer, and he said the Great War wasn't all doom and gloom, you know, we had some good times as well. So I thought it was in perspective, because I expect it was like that.
What do you remember of your schooling?
Well, I went to a prep school, and about the only thing I can remember after that, then I went to Marlborough, and I was there from 1935 to 39. And there we had two parades of the OTC per week, Wednesday afternoon, and Friday was a half parade, I think it was. And we knew jolly well that it was really for a war. I don't think before the war, before the Great War anyway, they hadn't liked so many parades. And I didn't like boarding school. I don't think I met anybody who did. They wouldn't admit it if they had anyhow. But I had a very good friend called Hugh McKernan, and he was joined the RAF. He was a night fighter mosquito, and he's coming back from a patrol or a raid over Germany, I suppose. He crashed into the North Sea, and that was killed him. But in fact, all the people my year at school were killed. The other one, the three of us went up in January 35. One was Hugh, the other was me, and another one was Michael Crawford, and he was killed in the Fleet Air Arm. His also actually in a training accident. And the one who came after me was killed over one of the Norway convoys. So during the war, I lost all my friends. I've got a lot of new ones, but they're all dead now because they're all getting rather old, or would be. In fact, I don't think anybody I know now. Well, one person was at my prep school. He was in Brighton. I've met him since.
On the academic side of things, had you any particular favourite subject?
Yes, I was very keen on zoology and animals. I liked it, and my father encouraged me, because he was, by the time we went there, he was medical officer of health for Lambeth. And the 1939, when the war was due, we went on holiday to Cornwall to stayed on a farm. And we'd all been quite keen on horse riding, and They had a field with some jumps in and so on. It was, so we could play, do this as much as we liked. And one of my had three sisters, the youngest one, became very keen on show jumping and became rather expert at it. My elder sister, I was the oldest of the four, the older one got a blue at London University for fencing, and the second one at Oxford for tennis. And I've always been absolutely useless at ball games, anyway. I don't know about other ones. Anyway, but ball games, I seem to misjudge the speed all the time. And I went on this farm towards the end of August. There were all sorts of telegrams coming through every day and urgent telephone messages and things. So we decided, our family, to pack up and come back on Sunday. Before that was, I think, the 1st of September. Anyway, by that time it was thought, they thought you'd probably better go back right away. So we had an incredible amount of suitcases and trunks and things. I think it must have come by rail before. So we went back with it. We had a huge Austin 16 those days, and we had a suitcase on either side of the bonnet with a strap across, a big trunk on the back, and other luggage everywhere else. And we just sort of packed into this thing. And we went back, and we got as far as Dulverton, where my uncle, the one who was in Salonika, and his wife were staying. And my mother and the three girls were left there at a hotel we'd stayed at a previous year. And my aunt and uncle came in the car. And I drove, because I was old enough to drive. I was 18, or nearly. Yes, I was 18 then, 39. So I drove most of the way, because the others were quite happy to be talking. And that suited me. We started in the evening, it got dark, and we got nearly as far as Taunton, when we were stopped by an army officer who said, no headlights, you've got to use side lights only. Then my father had a spell of driving, got us onto Salisbury Plain, and we stopped for coffee. Then I drove all the way back home, and my aunt and uncle stayed the night in our spare room, and they went off to their flat in Chelsea. And my father and I went in the morning. We went to the town hall, Lambeth Town Hall, and I was supposed to be helping him, and I was signing people on for stretcher bearers and nurses and all that sort of thing for the first aid posts. And while I was there, I think it was on the 3rd of September when the war started, we heard Chamberlain's speech, and then operating a telephone at that time, and one of the girls, one of the regular, whose job it was to operate the thing, gave a yell, said, "I'm being bombarded, children being bombarded." Well, shortly after, it was just before the siren sounded, which I think was a mistake, actually. And then they cleared up afterwards, but everybody was laughing at this misunderstanding. And then I was there for 2 or 3 weeks, signing people on and, for these jobs and that kind of thing, helping him out and sort of minor jobs, because nothing happened for a long while. Then they got talked into sending me back to school, whereas my friends had already gone on to university. But as soon as I got back, several of us who were in the same state managed to get leave for a day from school, and we went to Reading and all joined up.
Had the OTC been compulsory while you had been at school?
OTC was not compulsory, that's a good question. But if you didn't go in the OTC, you had to join the Scouts, and that was considered very much worse than the OTC. And the only person who ever got out of the OTC was called Morgan, and he said he was a conscientious objector and he'd get out. But it didn't do him any good, because as soon as he left school, he joined the regular army as in the artillery. And I remember the housemaster being very cross, saying, there he joined the OTC, he's a conscientious objector. First thing he does is joins up the army. But I think he did it for a lark, he didn't, he thought he'd ever succeed. And Human Kern and I, we did our first 3 years ordinary OTC training. The best parts were the field days which we had. They were rather fun. And we would go, we'd get special rations and things. And after we'd got our certificate A, which was for the, it said that it gave you right to a commission in the Territorial Army or in the regular army of the Commonwealth countries. But in actual fact, it didn't do anything like that at all, because after I joined up, I still had to stay there for one term at Cambridge, at Marlborough, which was very, very boring to me. They had a 13-pounder gun, so I was able to see how the gun worked. It didn't help at all, that really, because it was nothing like a 2-pounder, which we used in the tanks. But I got in, I tried to do everything I could. Eventually, I couldn't get a job of any sort, really, because I was, until the Home Guard started, and I joined that, and I got a Ross rifle, and it was covered in oil from the Americans. I cleaned that up. I joined the OTC at Cambridge in 1940 when I joined up there, but I was a non-parading member for the first term because it was absolutely full. Everybody had joined it, and so I did do some rowing then. And the second term, the summer term when I went up, so after that,
this is in Cambridge.
At Cambridge, yes, in 1940. Second time when I went up, all of the races, May Week was cancelled. Everything was cancelled, because Dunkirk had taken to us. So we were all sent off, and still I couldn't get into the army. And so that was when I joined the OTC, and I worked on a farm and things like that with one or two friends from Cambridge who were equally frustrated, because we all wanted to get in as quickly as possible, because in a sort of way we thought we'd smash the Germans in no time and the war would be over before we could get into it. But we went to training regiment at Tidworth. And that was, I think, in September. And first thing there was being offered a clean equipment. I was given a gas mask, which was all covered in blood and so on. So it was quite good. And injections in this old stable full of straw. It was quite rough. And then the training was quite interesting. There were two squads, 49A squad and B squad, and we were B squad, which was the last of people who got Certificate A, I think. And so we all had quite a bit of experience, whereas the A squad had none. And so we did quite well. And we couldn't be ill, because if you were, you'd drop a troop, and then you probably wouldn't be selected automatically for Sandhurst or Blackburn. Anyway, I was one of the lucky ones who went to Sandhurst, and from really rather rough way of living, we lived in great comfort with tablecloths on the table, and our buttons weren't polished enough, we were told to keep our batman up to scratch, and that sort of thing. And the last time before that I left, I was being with Hugh McKernan, we'd been in the band, which was rather fun. We did some crazy things there. One, for example, was they had a light, a flashing light to represent a machine gun. So the band platoon had to put their instruments in the lorry and have rifles instead. And so I said, let's form close order and charge the hill, firing as we go. And it was quite fun to us, but we got up, the machine gunners didn't know quite what to do either. And then an umpire came up and said, you're all dead, go away. And so we spent the rest of the day feeding under lunch under in the shade of a haystack. Anyway, once we got to Tidworth, it became much more serious, and the main thing is we were short of equipment. I think the whole time there only fired about 7 rounds of 303, and that type of thing was very curtailed. We used to fire on a pellet range, where when you pulled the trigger of what was supposed to be a 2-pounder, an air rifle fired a pellet with moving tanks, and they said you'd be able to, so we could fire on the move, because the elevation was on the shoulder of the gunner. But in fact, as soon as we got into Libya, we found that you couldn't fire accurately on the move at all. It's a waste of time. You always had to halt. And so while I was at Sandhurst, the War Office decided that several of the cavalry regiments were under strength, whereas the RTR had surplus officers. So a party came round and said, recruiting, and he said, I don't know who they were, actually, what regiment they were recruiting for. And the first question said, do you play polo? So I said, no, but I can ride a horse. And because we had had proper lessons. And the next thing was, they said, why did you put down RTR as your first choice? I said, well, I haven't got a private income. So they said, well, why did you put down 17th, 21st Lancers as your second choice? And I said, oh, I rather like the idea of Death or Glory on their cap badges. So he said, oh, you'd be exactly the right person for 4th Hussars. And so I got roped into the 4th Hussars. And I said, oh, it was Churchill's regiment anyway, so I thought it was quite nice. But it was a real snag in that, because when we got our commissions into the 4th Hussars, it was back to Tidworth, training regiment. And there I was with somebody called David Gotch, and we did very badly there. We overslept one morning. We were at parties all night, and all day you had to be frightfully formal. And I was in disgrace, because one morning I was shared a room with Teddy Zissou, who's a Romanian whose family owned oil wells and things, were quite well off. And he was killed afterwards, I think, in the First Army. But he said to me one day, he was doing a wireless operation training, and I had a gap between one gunnery team I was teaching and the next. And he said, can you help me out? So I said, yes, of course, I'd used to do that. So I went to RHQ, and the adjutant wasn't there, the colonel wasn't there, and the second in command wasn't there. So I wrote a note and said, I've gone taking a wireless troop on an exercise. And when I came back, I was sent for by the second in command. And he said, what do you mean by going off without permission? So I said, well, at Sandhurst we were taught to do what we were told, or we thought would be told by a senior officer, had one been present. And I thought it was a sensible thing to do. And he must have looked up my papers, because he said, that's the trouble with you university people, you always think. When I was a subaltern in 1914, we did what we were told, and nobody thought at all. So, he was actually RTR, not 4th Hussars. So we were rather glad when, shortly after that, the colonel called for us. David Gotch was in disgrace for something else. And he said, 4th CLY are going abroad, and Bill Carr, Colonel Carr's written asking for volunteers. So David Gotch and I said, we volunteer straight away. So he had, I think, 24 hours leave, joined the regiment, and we sailed from Liverpool just a week afterwards.
If we pause there, just go back to Sandhurst a little bit, perhaps. How did I suppose the system of training work at Sandhurst, and how were the days? What was the course of an average day? Perhaps
We had parades 6 o'clock in the morning, I think. One morning, they had a trumpet blowing in the corridors of the old building. The new building was infantry at that time, but in the old building was cavalry and armoured corps. And David Gotch and I both overslept. And we looked out of the window, and there we saw the battalion on parade. Much to our horror. And so we thought, what on earth should we do now? And then we had a brainwave. We reported sick. And we got there, and they said, you know perfectly well, the sick parade isn't until 9 o'clock. Come back at 9. So then we got away with it. But you got put on a charge for all minor things when you sent us. I think really to teach us how to do it. And both there and at Didworth, everything was incredibly fair. If you had Ben Huff, who was a friend of mine, went into the bays. He, one day, we were off a route march, and the sergeant came round and lifted up, and he found his valise on the back wasn't heavy enough. Instead of being stuffed with a great coat and various other things like that, he put in the evening standard and bundled. So, of course, he got several extra drills. And the sergeant, would be terribly rude to us on parade, and then we'd meet him at Naffy afterwards and have a beer with him, and we got on very well. We were very friendly with them all. And nobody ever had anything held against them. Same thing at Sandhurst. If you're up on a charge, you got your punishment or an extra drill or two extra drills or something. But it was never held against you. I think that was remarkable. I'm really quite impressed by that. One thing did happen for Christmas before, when we were still at Didworth. The first people A to N or something like that went on Christmas Day. We stayed at the people later on. I was T for Thompson. We went up the following weekend for one night. And coming back, we got to Waterloo Station, and it was a big fire raid on London. And the whole place was, like, you could read the newspaper all the way. And my car came in too, into the station. And then I couldn't find the RTO to report that I'd come up to catch the train to go back. And when we were driving back, eventually we put down on the underground, towards the underground, but every time a bomb fell, the floor we were on went up and down. It was very, very unsafe sort of place. We managed to slip out at the end without being noticed. We got out and we got out into York Road, but we couldn't get through there because there were factories both sides burning and firemen on the top of their lorries. And my father had a white steel hat because he was in charge of the rescue teams and things in Lambeth. And I remember a fire burning, somebody saying, look, there's an incendiary up in the roof there. What can we do about it? I think he was something to do with the defence, but he couldn't do anything. Anyway, we managed to get round the other way by Lower Marsh and got up, got in the car, and drove away. And I was driving home while he was looking out to see where the fires were in Lambeth on the way and making notes and things. We got home and spent the night there, and the next morning I got a train at midday from Clapham Junction, plus on the train were nearly all the other people from London who hadn't been able to get back. That was quite interesting.
Was that your first experience of the bombing?
No, there had been, the first experience was the Croydon raid, before I was in the army. I was playing tennis with my sisters and some friends of them. And we saw some planes whizzing about in the distance, which was Croydon's. And so we stopped playing and we went home. But by the time we got home, the alarm had gone. Of course, the raid came before the alarm went off. And many things like that were not very good to begin with. It got very efficient later on. It was Dad's army-ish conditions to begin with.
How did you find the adjustment to military life and discipline and so on while at Sandhurst?
Well, it wasn't altogether very different from school in many ways. And it was so nice having comfort and so on, whereas the other half of the squad had been sent to Blacktown. Didn't have batmen, they had to do their own polishing and all that sort of thing. And when they came to visit us on Saturday afternoon sometimes, things like that, we realized how lucky we were to go be in Santa's. It had a very nice, fancy, good shop where you could buy all kinds of books and things. It was really, really good. Anyway, after the regiment sailed, we went to, we didn't know where we were going. There was rumors that we were going to all sorts of places, Caribbean and so on. We were issued with solar topies and tropical kit as well as ordinary clothes. And we were on Strathnava. It was a fast convoy, Strathnava, Strathmore and the Iran, and three cargo ships with the tanks on them. And we went round the Cape. Well, we stopped in Freetown, and that was the only stop. And after that, one morning we woke up and we saw that the Strathmore had got a great shark's mouth in the front. It had run into the Revenge. When we were left, we were convoyed by a cruiser and eight destroyers. But from Freetown, we had the Revenge, and the steering went wrong on the Revenge. It went across the front and damaged this boat, so it slowed us up a bit. So we had a shorter time in Cape Town as a result. But the South Africans incredibly hospitable, and we were taken to all kinds of parties and things and formal dances. And then from there, we went right through to, we came to Suez. We stopped at Aden for 3 or 4 days, which were incredibly hot. I think it was 45 or something like that. And one of the stewards who had been with P&O for 20 years died of heat stroke there. And he was buried at sea. And to make things a little bit more interesting, they lowered the lifeboats and had races for the soldiers in the regiment. Each ship had one regiment of the 22nd Armored Brigade and a lot of reinforcements. And apart from the fact that we were two to a single cabin, again I was put in with David Gotch for some reason, we were in great luxury. He had a batman called Reeval, and Reeval came in one morning and saw the rows and rows of drinks, because double whiskey cost tuppence, I think, and a double gin and lime, threepence. And they never measured it out. They just gave you half a glass of whiskey and a splash of soda in it. And really, it was really, could have been, everybody could have been terribly drunk. But although there were some quite heavy drinkers, nobody got very drunk.
How else did you spend your time during the voyage?
Well, in the morning we were doing, we started PT before breakfast. That was the most awful time with hangovers and things, but after that we had breakfast. Then we did, sometimes we did toots with we did exercises too with a sheet and moving corks over it to represent tanks over, and there were lectures from people about, we'd been mostly the Battle of Gaza and the Great War and so on. And we learned Arabic. Jack Pierce, my friend there, he taught Arabic. He knew, he thought he was going to keep up. He'd work up one day for the day ahead all the time. And we went through a detailed account of Allenby's campaign in Palestine. And the afternoon was off when we were playing games mostly, deck tennis or the kind of things you do on boats. And then we had plenty of time for reading and had dinner, and after dinner people were chatting away and talking. The food was incredibly good after the rations in England. And then we went to sleep, and up at the crack of dawn, it seemed,